This is World to Win, bringing you the latest news and analysis from a socialist perspective.
Welcome back. On this special episode of World to Win, we'll be discussing the brutal and murderous onslaught of Gaza and the war crisis in Israel-Palestine. The world has looked on in horror at the barbaric actions of the Israeli state and the prospect of a regional war inflaming the entire Middle East. And already millions have taken to the street across the globe in solidarity with the Palestinian masses calling for an end to the bloodshed. At the time of recording, which is Monday evening in Europe, the death toll in Gaza stands at 9,770, with 24,808 injured, figures that are growing by the minute. And even when this episode is finally aired, that number will have passed the truly horrifying 10,000 mark. In fact, with 2,260 people currently missing, the figure likely passed that ghastly milestone in the last number of days. The scale of the massacre is unprecedented as the Israeli state turns the 16-year blockade into a complete siege with elements of genocide, starving 2.3 million people, cutting off access to water and electricity, which Israel controls. Over 40,000 houses have been destroyed. 1.5 million of the Gaza population have been displaced, and over one third of hospitals have been shut down. But even these shocking figures do not capture the grief, the tragedy and the unspeakable suffering currently experienced by those in Gaza. To quote Bisan Dadu, a Gazan journalist, "And even if we survive the white phosphorus, even if we survive the bombing in the schools, in the hospitals, in our homes, there is no food, there is no water. All we have is the salty water from the sea. There is no products, there is no food, there is no aid, there is nothing. We are dying because of hunger." And sadly, there's no end in sight. We've seen Netanyahu more recently rejecting calls for a ceasefire, making clear that, and I quote, "this is a time for war." He's referred to the onslaught as a, quote, "battle of civilization against barbarians." And of course, here he's attempting to exploit much of the genuine grief and rage in the wake of the October 7th Hamas attacks. These targeted civilians and involved the indiscriminate massacre of hundreds of people, and the taking of more than 240 hostages from all nationalities. It included women, children, even opponents of the occupation. I think such elements, such methods, are utterly reactionary and counterproductive to the struggle for Palestinian liberation, and they should be opposed. But we would like to say, before going any further, that World to Win, ISA, and Socialist Struggle Movement, which is ISA in Israel-Palestine, stand in solidarity and bow our heads in memory of all the victims of ordinary people on both sides of the fence in the events that continue the national oppression and cycle of bloodshed. And we pledge to be an uncompromising voice, demanding an immediate halt to the bombings and the revenge campaign of the Netanyahu, Ben-Gvir, Gantz government, which is wreaking destruction of unprecedented proportion, designed above all to protect the root cause of the current crisis, which is a reality of siege and extreme national oppression of millions of Palestinians under the rule of Israeli capital. So we're faced with an impossible looking situation. I think it's important now more than ever to develop a program and strategy to end the bloodshed. But in order to point the way forward, we need to have a correct analysis of the complex interplay of factors that have brought us to this point. And with us today to do that, we have Bayan, Tuval, and Yasha from Socialist Struggle Movement, which is, as I said before, is ISA in Israel-Palestine. So to kick things off, I want to start with Yasha and ask if you can just tell us a bit more about the conditions in Gaza right now after almost 1 month of war. And can you tell us how that situation has developed in the past 3 weeks?
Yeah, well, the autocracies, of course, are unprecedented. It needs to be stressed that the slaughter that we are seeing now unfolding in Gaza in front of our eyes is unprecedented, not only in comparison to the wars of the last 15 years, but also if you look at the past decades. You already mentioned the numbers, Dara, and at least 4,000 children have been killed by the Israeli bombing on Gaza, that is subjected to brutal bombardment, not only from the air, but also from the sea and the land. And on a Sunday night, just one day before of our recording, we witnessed again this horror, a complete interruption of the internet and communication of Gaza with the world and of Gazans, the Palestinian residents in Gaza with each other. And exactly after we saw those reports, the war, another Syria of bombardments that were described by the residents as the most brutal and violent ones since the start of the war. And this looked like a preparation for ground invasion into the densely populated Gaza City, which is an even bloodier phase of this months-old war. The Gaza Strip is now basically divided by the Israeli army into two different areas, north and south, and the residents are being ordered for already 2 to 3 past weeks to evict from the northern part, when Gaza City is located, to the southern part. But it needs to be absolutely stressed that no place is safe in this tiny strip of land. And also in the south of the strip, for example in Deir al-Balah, entire families were buried under the rubble in bombardment. And this is an area that's supposed to be the one that Gaza residents should flee to from the bombings in the northern part of the enclave. And basically what we see is just a displacement of hundreds upon hundreds of thousands. 1.5 million people in Gaza, which is 70% of the population of the strip, is now internally displaced, and many of them trying to find the shelter in schools, hospitals, and different facilities, but they are totally overcrowded and many just sleeping on the streets. This creates a severe threat for also for the physical and mental health of the internally displaced families. And of course, those facilities cannot be really called shelters because they are bombarded time and time and time again by the Israeli army. And besides of that, as you mentioned, water is a huge issue. And this is something that I want to go a little bit more into, just to understand how severe is the situation, because the damage to water and sanitation infrastructure limited the availability of running water, but also there is lack of fuel to pump water, and this has created a huge health crisis already at this stage, when there is hundreds of thousands of residents also in Gaza City that are facing severe water shortages, and the municipal run wells are unable to pump water due to lack of fuel. In the south, all municipal wells have stopped operation since the 2nd of November. We are recording this on the 6th. And on the 4th and the 5th of November, this means yesterday and the day before that, seven different water facilities across the Gaza Strip was directly hit and sustained major damages by the bombardments. And what does it also mean for hospitals? I mean, we can speak here for long time about the condition of the health system, but let's just give you one example, and allow me to quote a doctor at Shifa Hospital, Dr. Marwan Abu Sada, who is the head of the surgery unit, and he says that, and I quote him, "We have a huge issue with water shortages. All departments in Shifa have no water for 8 hours, as it will be completely cut off, and then when we receive water, we only receive salty water that cannot be used for hygiene or drinking. We have minimum access to drinking water." And then he explained how the Israeli army made sure to cut off also the hospital from all vital lifelines, not only water, but also electricity, fuel, medication, food. The fuel that they are left are no longer served the hospital for lifeline purposes, but for example, only particular units, like surgical wards that have patients recovering from surgery, have no electricity at this stage, and only ICU and ER have them. And these conditions are well beyond anything that can be described simply as a humanitarian crisis. Yeah, we hear it a lot in the media, a humanitarian crisis, but we went beyond this point where the whole enclave is basically a disaster area, but the disaster is going on with the going on bombardment that aggravated the situation, causing more damage to essential infrastructure, and as I said previously, is a slaughter on an unprecedented scale, and therefore no demand or for aid to be let in Gaza would be enough, and what should be demanded is an immediate halt to all the bombardments, to all the attacks by the Israeli army, to all the land invasions, a complete ceasefire, and the immediate stoppage to this massacre and to the war.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, as Yash just said, we're now in the 31st day of the war, and also there should be some questions also to be asked, mostly about women and non-binary people, what they really do in these difficult times, and how really also their bodies, how do they force their bodies to overcome pains of nature. And there are some stuff that we need to take into consideration. For example, in Gaza, but also in everywhere, women and non-binary people having their periods really try to prevent their natural circle by using birth control pills to stop the cycle. For example, the most common day finishing the natural cycle and starting menstruation, it's the 27th day. So we just passed this day, and now many people and women in Gaza are kind of they don't have endless supplies of those pills. And as also Yasha said, the water isn't clean, and there is no supply also for example clean facilities and also hospitals. Women and people are being displaced in hospitals, hospital corridors, streets and houses, and that's really makes it difficult for women and people really dealing with these hard times. And also, for example, I think 3 years, 3 days ago, the World Health Organization announced that there's about 50,000 pregnant women and people in Gaza, and about 180 giving birth every day. And as the conditions are being worse, 15% of them are experiencing complications related to pregnancy and childbirth, and they really need medical treatment, and also treatment for children that have been birthed. But at the same time, we are massacres are occurred in hospitals, and the hospitals many hospitals as also have been mentioned have been shut down. But for example, last week there were bombings in 3 hospitals in Gaza: Shifa Hospital, the Indonesian Hospital, and the Al-Quds Hospital, the only hospital for cancer patients in Gaza. And also today, Monday, as we are recording, there were a bombing in the third floor in the Al-Shifa hospital. The third floor, the only floor that has cancer children. Also, about 2 weeks ago, we saw that there was a massacre in El Ahli hospital. This also I really wanted to add.
Thanks very much, Bian and Yasha, for giving us that account. And I think, as both went into the scale of the suffering and misery and the many different dimensions to that, in terms of the particular impact it's having on women, is something yet that, yes, even the brutal reports, images, and videos we see coming of these scenes, I don't think it adequately expresses them. And as Yasha said, even the term humanitarian crisis is inadequate at this stage. So ruthless and grim are the actions of the Israeli regime. Now, while attention is focused on Gaza, I think it is also important to talk about what's been taking place in the occupied territories, the West Bank and occupied East Jerusalem, where there has been an upsurge in attacks by settlers backed and supported by Israeli state forces. So, Tuval, can you tell me a bit more about that, please?
So since the 7th of October, low intensity war is being waged by the Israeli state in the West Bank, with the Israeli occupation forces killing 153 Palestinians, including children, people with special needs. We've seen horrific videos and testimonies of torture of Palestinians detained by settlers and Israeli soldiers. Many times, settlers themselves showing the connection between the army and the settlement project. Basically, the process of ethnic cleansing that has been taking place before the 7th of October, but it's violently increased now with a forceful transfer of more than a dozen Palestinian communities in the sea territories. And in occupied East Jerusalem, young Palestinians are also facing a more brutal oppression by the Israeli police. Basically, the process of ethnic cleansing, both in the West Bank and occupied Eastern Jerusalem, has increased in the past few years, with Israeli governments promoting a slow annexation of the West Bank under apartheid regime. And Israeli settler violence backed by the Israeli army and government has also increased with 2023 has been the highest death toll in the West Bank since 2005, and that was before the 7th of October. It was already seen the highest death toll in the West Bank since 2005. 2005 is when the UN began collecting the data. In Eastern Jerusalem, we've seen families such as the Sublaban family thrown out from their home, and which was taken over by settlers. And we've seen also many violent attacks, stealing since the rise of this Netanyahu government with the far right last year, where we've seen more and more violent attacks. And now, since the 7th of October, we've seen really a worsening of that. In Hawara, which suffered a pogrom in February and it has been targeted since, we've seen since the 7th of October a military lockdown, which was enforced on the main streets, with residents having to get approval from the Israeli army on every basic day-to-day task, like getting approval from the army to cross the main street and throw the rubbish. And these were just a few examples, which is what is happening with the war as a cover to dramatically increase the ethnic cleansing and the processes that were already underway.
Thanks, Duval. Bian, would you like to add anything onto that as well?
There were like lots of workers that have been arrested since this like just for a context, like there are lots of workers, Palestinian workers from Gaza in the West Bank that are working in the 1948 territories, aka Israel, and Israeli borders, like inter-Israeli borders. And so everyone were shocked, and everyone didn't really expect what happened. And many like workers come to the 1948 territory for working, and because also like the economic situation in Gaza is very bad. And like many workers were actually in Israel when the attack happened, and Israel just arrested all of the Gazan workers that were into its borders, and just like canceled all the insurance for them to stay in Israel for work. And so what happened, like it was like kind of a revenge. It was like a kind of a revenge act, actually, to do that. And and they arrested about 3,200 Gazan workers, and actually last week they were released. And the Gazan workers say that they were like brutally attacked. They were stolen. The money that they worked for, they stole it. And also they were like needed like to stay in the prison for 3 weeks since the war. And and so also like they didn't really know about their family in Gaza, what's happening with them. Because of the aggression. And so also they were released, and many of them needed also to enter Gaza and to really be into this aggression, into this hell. And many of them, like their families were their family members were killed. And that's really like also like it's added to the really violent attacks and like revenge acts on Palestinians. Also an act like to show the Israeli people that yeah, the government is doing something and trying like kind of to cover the failures that they had recently.
Thanks both to Tuval and Mian there for that information and updates. I think at the moment there are a lot of people searching for answers, for reasons, historical and otherwise, about how we got to this point. And I think it's fair to say that the brutal eruption of this war has deep roots in the bloody history of the region and the long oppression of Palestinians. So I think for Tuval and Bian again, can both of you go in a bit to explain that and how it's manifested in today's atrocities?
Yeah, I mean, as we mentioned, the days following the horrors of the 7th of October saw the escalation of continuing policies towards Palestinian people in the region since the Nakba 75 years ago. And we saw how continuously the Israeli governments have been trying to break between the different Palestinian communities in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Eastern Jerusalem, and within the 1948 territories, trying to treat, and we see the different policies. So if on Gaza the blockade of 16 years has become a total siege with no water, no medicine, no electricity, we see in the West Bank where the process of settlements and ethnic cleansing going on is now escalating, and in the occupied Eastern Jerusalem as well.
Yeah, actually, I think also many people have seen that picture of the bombing of Jabalia refugee camp last week, the second largest bomb that they were like throwing to this camp. And it's also most like one of the most densely populated place in Gaza. You know, all of Gaza is densely populated, but this place is very, very populated, and more than 400 people were killed in this massacre. And you know, the photo of the bombing and the destruction really is very similar to the destruction 75 years ago. And they show a photo like of destruction in Java. In Java now, like it's a part of Israel. And many people that were like that in this refugee camp were actually displaced. And their parents were displaced from Java in the center of Israel. And really it emphasizes the historical background of these people that were displaced 75 years ago and were also attacked brutally 75 years ago. They were under occupation for hundreds of years, and now they are 16 years under siege. And also it should be like into consideration that the refugee camps are under more bad conditions than the other places in Gaza. And that's really emphasized that this Nakba is not a thing that happened 75 years ago only. It's like a continuous act by the Israeli regime, and its a policy that they are also talking about it for like really even having Gaza and annexing it after really demolishing it. One of the dreams of a right wing. Politicians and the government.
Thanks, Bian. I think it's really useful to have that historical context, and actually it helps us to understand maybe some of the comments we've heard in the recent period, where several Israeli politicians and journalists have called openly for a genocide. Just yesterday, we had a far-right minister saying nuking Gaza is an option, and leading members of the Israeli government, like War Minister Yoav Gallant, using extremely dehumanizing rhetoric to justify this total siege. So I want to ask Yasha now, what is the Israeli regime trying to achieve with this revenge massacre?
Yeah, I think first we need to look soberly at what is unfolding in front of our eyes, and it's not just a catastrophe, but a barbaric onslaught that have clearly and extremely horrifying elements of genocide and of ethnical cleansing already at this stage, which are also a huge warning sign for the whole course of this war. And as you said, there are far-right ministers, members of the Knesset, and other figures in the Israeli regime that are openly pushing for a genocidal war, and some of them are also pushing for the renewal of the colonial settlements inside the Gaza Strip. The expense of the Palestinians' towns and villages, and it would be a mistake if we disregard them as a fringe elements, because in this current Netanyahu government with the alliance in the far right, they managed to grab powers that they never got before, and in the same time, the war is a direct continuation of the previous policies of the Israeli regime against the Palestinians, only by a more brutal means. And I think it was also clear in the historical background that was given now by both Beyan and Tuval. And I think that it is fair to say what was the main purpose of the siege on Gaza at the first place, because in a sense, the war continues the same policy, and it was to imprisoned 2 million Palestinians, 2.5 million Palestinians actually, in the enclave, and to isolate them from the rest of the Palestinian communities in the occupied West Bank, in East Jerusalem, and throughout the historic Palestine, 1948 territories, and by this to divide and weaken Palestinians as a nation fighting for its liberation. So this was part of the overall strategy of the Israeli regime. And the main purpose of this war, from the standpoint of the Israeli ruling class and the high command of the army and its imperialist backers, is to basically reorganize this imprisonment of the Palestinians in Gaza, and also to reorganize the local authorities within this prison, with this huge open-air prison, and to have basically more reliable guards on the other side of the prison wall, more reliable than the leadership of Hamas. But they're not sure how they will actually achieve it and who will be ready to play this role, to take this upon themselves. And therefore, what is cynically called in the international press the end game of this war is debated within the Israeli regime and between the Israeli regime and its imperialist backers, particularly the White House. And at this stage, they are not clear and also not sure about their ability to occupy and hold Gaza under their control without having a huge destabilization effect in the region, but also for millions upon millions of people around the globe taking to the streets to protest this brutal war and these brutal policies, and to protest the governments that are backing them up, whether it's by money or by diplomatic support. But what is also clear is that those goals will not be achieved from the very simple reason that the Palestinian masses themselves in Gaza and actually anywhere else will not be ready to remain prisoners, and will be not ready to remain an oppressed nation, but will rise again and again against the continuation of the current status quo that is perpetuate their oppression. And therefore we say that this status quo is untenable, first and foremost, not for the capitalist elites and the imperialist powers, but first and foremost for the people on the ground. And therefore, what we would see with the continuation of this war is more opposition, more resistance, more international solidarity and action on the international scale. And actually, in the consequences of that, also more questioning among the Israeli society about the goals of this war and the policies of the government, and this will push them to even more profound crisis that they are actually experiencing already.
Thanks, Yasha. So just, you finished on talking about the impact that more resistance, more opposition, and more international solidarity will have on how this war unfolds. And crucially, at the end, you mentioned about the dynamics in Israeli society itself. So I want to ask Tuval to give more information, more of an insight, and what is the mood and conditions within the 1948 territories at this moment.
So, I mean, the first few days after the 7th of October, there was utter shock. Why What was so shocking was the fact that the Israeli army, which is the strongest army in the region, backed by Western imperialism, was taken by surprise and that the siege was temporarily broken. But soon, during the 7th of October, it became clear from social media, WhatsApp groups, Telegram channels, the extent and level of the horrors being committed, where most casualties of the attack initiated by Hamas were civilians, more than 1,000, including acts of rape and torture of children and babies also, with whole families being wiped out. Hamas's attacks were indiscriminate, where super exploited agricultural Thai workers and Nepalese students were murdered. And families in working class towns from Jewish, Northern African and Middle Eastern population, as well as Palestinians living within 1948 territories with Israeli citizenship, were also murdered and kidnapped. Palestinian bus drivers who attempted to save partygoers, a Bedouin family was kidnapped, is in Gaza at the moment. And also the rockets fired by the militias, they threaten Bedouin communities who are suffer from racist state discrimination and oppression and do not have shelters at all. The Iron Dome system does not protect them. The state refuses to build shelters as part of the policy not to allow Bedouins to build permanent buildings. And poor and working class communities of Jewish Israelis living in the south who don't also, they also don't have shelters. And also more than 330,000 Israelis who had to evacuate mostly from the south, but also from the border in the north because of the, again, low intensity war being fought with Hezbollah. And the reactionary indiscriminate natures of the 7th of October attacks gives the Israeli state more ammunition to gain support for the slaughter among Israeli society, as well as the international campaign where they try to justify the atrocities that cannot be justified. But reactionary events also shocked communities, both Jewish, Palestinian, and other national communities within 1948 territories to the core. And if usually during previous rounds of war and bloodshed and attacks on Gaza, we've seen demonstration against Israeli attacks and bombardment organized already on the same day. In this crisis, the reactionary nature of the events had a shock effect on Palestinian communities within 1948 territories on the left at large. While there was vast opposition, at least within Palestinian communities, to the war from day one, but of course, as the atrocities committed in Gaza worsened and keep worsening, the severe political repression is the main reason that we haven't seen yet demonstrations, at least of Palestinian communities within 1948 in the same level as we saw, for example, in the uprisings of the May 2021.
Yeah, and I think what I've been reading in the news, and also I recommend our listeners to go on to International Socialist Alternative, our ISA, our website, to read first-hand accounts from some of our members there dealing with this question of state repression. And it really is unprecedented. You have a crackdown on even some milder forms and expressions of dissent and criticism of the siege. So, Brian, can you tell us a little bit about the police repression of protests, the political prosecution, and the witch hunts that we've seen in the last days and weeks?
Yeah, of course. First of all, the political repression is not a new phenomenon. But it's unprecedentedly increased on the 7th of October. Like, as we mentioned earlier, like there are many attempts like to protest against the war within Israel, and the Israeli state and the police is doing everything in its power really to stop and repress it. For example, 2 weeks ago, an anti-war protest in the Parsian town of Umm Al Fahim was violently dispersed by the police within 12 arrests, including minors, and there are still two people are still arrested, like from 2 weeks. Also, there were like a Palestinian demonstration in Haifa that even didn't begin before like arrests were made, and also it was dispersed. Also, we have seen that like a Jewish Palestinian anti-war conference that was organized was also cancelled because the police threatened the venue, and because it was too risky for them to talk about the war and to have a Jewish Palestinian conference together. But this also like this repression, it's also like taken like from a political persecution, and it's like we are seeing like a phenomenon of witch hunt in workplaces and campuses. For example, that there is like lots of student unions, you know, and management like are encouraging students to report on their Palestinian and work colleagues, and kind of to fight what they call support Hamas or terrorism. But at the same time, many students or have been drafted to the military because of the war. It's more than 100 students have already been summoned to disciplinary hearings, and some of them were kicked out of the academic institutions as well as the student dorms without even hearings. While Jewish students were calling to flatten Gaza genocide, calls for leftists to kill themselves or not being disciplined at all. And it's also like added to a lot to many many acts of the Israeli academia, the militant Israeli academia that promotes mostly for the IDF and programs that with a collaboration with them. Even we're seeing now that the far right kind of released policy of guilty until proven innocent. Yeah, so we're seeing the phenomenon of the far right realized actually that the policy of guilty until proven innocent really benefits them, as like many universities just kick people without hearings, and so they talk this for themselves and like just started faking posts, reporting old posts from, for example, Nakba memorial ceremonies, and even unrelated posts. Everything that is in Arabic is suspended. For example, quotes from the Quran were reported and followed with the disciplinary actions. Also, the persecution is seen on in the workplaces as well. For example, a teaching assistant, a Palestinian teaching assistant, was fired for a photo with the Palestinian flag from 2 years ago. A head of a hospital was fired for an old post with an Islamic flag that people say that it's similar to Hamas's flag. And many, many quotes from the Quran. Mostly the political witch hunt is like meant to scare any voice against the war and the aggression and the genocide that is committed. And first and foremost, charges Palestinians in 1948 territories who already were subject to persecution even before the war. We also have seen like many Jewish civilians from like Jewish and Arab towns and cities were threatening their Arab neighbors because they kind of don't want them to live beside them. For example, in a Jewish majority town next to Nazareth and Nof HaGalil. All of these persecutions like is happening from a place of insecurity of the regime. Like it's worried that the May 2021 events will be repeated, which included a historic uprising within the Arab citizens and towns, and like really high of the mass struggle, the dignity strike, a bit el karam, but also there it's afraid of reactionary elements of civil war within 1948 territories. Actually, the Israeli regime is afraid to lose control over the situation, so it's cracking down. There's also awareness of the political crisis of the Israeli government. We were involved in the movement against the witch hunt on campuses. We sent letters with hundreds of signatures to staff and students through the Higher Education Council, and there is really a need also to organize on campuses against those witch hunters, witch hunt, and really a persecution targeting mostly the Arab Palestinian students. It consists like in some universities, it consists mostly like half of the students, but like the Arab Palestinian minority in Israel, it's about 20% of the population in Israel.
Yeah, one thing that stood out to me there was this, that ramping up of oppression is a position of insecurity and cracking down so they don't lose control of the situation. And I think actually that's something we've discussed on World to Win has been a global feature, part of global capitalism's instability and the increasing need to rely on repression, whether that's in Russia at the outbreak of the war, whether that's the Chinese dictatorship, or even Western advanced capitalist quote unquote democracies, we see a tightening of repression being a key feature of this new era of capitalist crisis. But another of those features, which I think is extremely important to take into account for this discussion, is that this is taking place in an unprecedented period of inter-imperialist rivalry, namely between the US and China. One that's characterized by a ramping up of militarism, but also an escalation of national tensions. So I want to ask Yasha, how does this current war fit into this broader context of the new Cold War of inter-imperialist conflict? And is there a danger that this then escalates into a wider war within the region?
Yeah, so I think first of all, it needs to be emphasized that the danger is very real. We already spoke about the fact that this war was triggered by the indiscriminate attack of Hamas, but it is rooted in the barbaric national oppression of the Palestinian. And the other feature is that it was fueled from the very first day, and even before that, by imperialist power and the dynamic of the new Cold War. What we saw before the 7th of October is Biden pushing very aggressively for the so-called normalization process between its two main allies in the region, which is the Israeli regime and the Saudi regime. But this process was essentially made at the expense of the rights of the Palestinians, and one of its main net results would be to perpetuate the oppression of the Palestinians. So it's just one of the many examples how the different interests of the imperialist powers interplay here into the dynamic of the national conflict itself. But what we saw after the 7th of October was even more telling, when actually US imperialism seized the opportunity to try and strengthen its presence in the Middle East after almost 2 decades of decline of its standing in the region in the aftermath of the war in Iraq, and then with the eruption of the revolutions in the Middle East and North Africa in 2011, the civil war in Syria, the civil war in Yemen, all those actually were just adding on to the decline of the US power in the region. And it seems that they are trying to seize on this war to, not if even completely overturn the long-term tendency, but at least to try to do that. And the presence is being manifested also by growing military presence with aircraft carriers being sent to the region, to the waters of the Mediterranean Sea and the Red Sea, but also now we see a nuclear submarine arriving, and along with those weapons of mass destruction deployed to the region, there is also the deployment of bombs to the Israeli army and a whole number of visits by heads of states from Biden to Scholz to Macron and others that are coming basically to back up Netanyahu's government, which some of them called just few weeks beforehand dangerous and anti-democratic. But now they basically position themselves on the same page with them. Yeah, but it's not being done without hesitations and fears. We saw that Biden and Blinken during their visit were like invited to take part in the Israeli War Cabinet meeting. This is also unprecedented, and part of the thing why they did it from their part is kind of a damage control, when they afraid that after pumping up so much military and diplomatic support for the Israeli war machine, this can get out of control and basically entangle US imperialism in ongoing long war of occupation in Gaza, but also in an eruption of a new war of Israel against Lebanon, in Syria, and even an attempt by the Israeli regime to attack the nuclear facilities in Iran, which cannot be completely ruled out in this war crisis. Now, in Lebanon, what we see is daily skirmishes between the Israeli army and Hezbollah that intensified to a kind of a low-intensity war by itself. And there were more than 60 fighters of Hezbollah that were killed already. There were also casualties among Israeli troops and civilians. 4 civilians in Lebanon, including 3 children and their grandmother, were killed just recently in Israeli army attack in the south of Lebanon. And there were, tens of thousands of residents in south of Lebanon who left already their villages just from a very based like fear of the things like the sense of the things to come. And I mean, those developments are really closely monitored both by the Russian regime and also by China, who tried to seize on the vacuum that was created by the decline of US imperialism in the region in the recent years, and also quite intensively in the recent months. Now, the attacks of the Israeli regime in Syria were up until recently coordinated with the Russian regime, who have a military presence in Syria itself, of course, since the civil war, but apparently not any longer. And there is no doubt that Putin is trying to use this war in the Middle East as a distraction from his own brutal war against Ukraine. And both his regimes and the regime in China trying to seize the on this war to pose as potential peacemakers in the Middle East, but they don't want to see a regional war that will change the relation of forces in favor of their main opponent on the world stage, which is US imperialism. So I think both Russia and Chinese regime are also extremely nervous and irritated by the renewed expansion of US military presence in the region, and they can't and won't actually match it up immediately by a military presence of their own, definitely not China, but they will attempt to hold on their positions through kind of a war diplomacy. And you already see these, cynical moves in the UN Council to trying to veto each of others' decisions. So, the dynamic is such that when you try to, analyze the interests of any of the imperialist powers, no one of them is interested to unleash a full-scale regional war in the immediate term. But on the other hand, as happened many times in history, situations that have been fueled by dynamic of imperialist rivalry can simply get out of control due to miscalculation, due to different rouge elements. And also, what is need to be stressed is that Netanyahu's government, which is really threatened with a legitimacy crisis within the Israeli society, can attempt a more adventurous military attacks on a regional scale that can provoke such a scenario.
Thanks, Yasha. So you spoke about the different responses of the various imperialist powers to this crisis. And I think another thing to take into account, which I want to ask Tuval about, not only is the response of the masses across the world, and we've seen that the siege on Gaza, the oppression of Palestinians, has evoked enormous outpouring of solidarity internationally, being reflected in solidarity protests that seem to be growing in every corner of the globe. But particularly striking are the massive mobilizations within the region. Why are these so significant, and what impact have they had so far?
So I think that definitely, I mean, this outpouring of solidarity, I think, has been extremely significant, and it's very significant in the West, in Europe, in the United States, where there's been marches and demonstrations of hundreds of thousands of people, despite really repression of and attempts to prevent these solidarity demonstrations from happening. And this phenomenon is definitely extremely important in pressuring, and it's a factor in pressuring the US imperialism, Western imperialism in general. They have an effect of destabilizing where these countries already are in political, economic, social crises. And they definitely are a source of concern, and they do affect how Western imperialism from the first day of this war crisis has allowed the Israeli state to wage war and commit the atrocities and bomb indiscriminately and everything that we've spoken about. So this is very significant. And I would like to say that I think that extremely significant are the demonstrations and protests across the Middle East, North Africa, and the region. And the blast at the Al-Ahli hospital on the 17th of October, which killed hundreds of residents from northern Gaza, were forced to flee because of the bombing by the Israeli state, and they took shelter there. And that marked a turning point in terms of the protests in the region, because already on that horrible night, spontaneous solidarity protests that on a scale that wasn't seen before in the 10 days before that erupted throughout the Middle East, in Egypt, in Jordan, and also in Northern Africa, in Libya, in Tunisia, in Morocco, and also in Turkey, and more. And protesters in Jordan attempted to march to the Israeli embassy. There were protests also in the West Bank. We can talk about it later a bit more, but in Jenin and Ramallah, clashing with the police. And the strength of these protests, it had an impact. There was supposed to be a day after, there was supposed to be a meeting between Biden, the president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, and the president of Egypt, Assisi. And because of these protests, the King of Jordan was forced to cancel the summit meeting. Which would have been an attempt for U.S. imperialism to, again, have more control over how the Netanyahu-Ben-Gvir-Gantz government is managing the war crisis, and would give maybe more legitimacy as well. So this really showed the strength of the solidarity with Palestinians by the masses in the region that, by the way, the normalization process, it wasn't able to break. It was supposed to marginalize Palestinians, to break this solidarity, and it wasn't able to do that. And this solidarity with Palestine movement in the region, it threatens the stability of the Arab regimes who resort to oppressing the demonstrations with force and violence. But they also it causes the Arab regimes to increase the pressure on the Netanyahu Ben-Gvir-Gantz government. For example, Bahrain was recalling its ambassador. And I think that the strong response of the masses in the region really had an effect in curbing a full ground invasion. But however, we have been seeing in the past week and a half more of the limited ground invasions combined with brutal bombings from the air and also invasions from and attacks from the sea. And as they increase, the number of victims in Gaza continues to mount, and the danger for a broader escalation in the region continues and deepens. And such an escalation would be disastrous, catastrophic for ordinary people in the region. And this means that a further strengthening and expansion of the protest and the demonstration is something that is urgently needed now.
I want to go back to Bian now and ask about important protests and demonstrations in the occupied West Bank. And I want to ask Bian, what is the political character of these demonstrations? And can you let us know what are some of the main demands coming up and what that says about consciousness of workers, young people, of the masses within the occupied West Bank?
Yeah, so first of all, the Palestinian Authority is really facing like a legitimacy crisis within the West Bank. As it's known as a subcontractor of the occupation and by its like security collaborations with the Israeli regime, many protests and protesters were shouting like supporting Hamas and really being against the Palestinian Authority and its president Abu Mazen before actually attacking the Israeli regime and, you know, the massacre that are happening in the in Gaza, they are attacking one of the contributors to these massacres, the Palestinian Authority. One of the protests were shouting like, "Where are you, Abu Mazen?" After the massacre that happened in the Ahli Hospital, there were lots of spontaneous protests after a continuous dispersing of protests against the war that the Palestinian Authority did since the beginning of the war, joining the dispersing of protests that the Israeli regime have did. And actually, in that protest against the massacre of Al-Ahli Hospital, four protesters were shot and killed by the Palestinian Authority soldiers. Unfortunately, it's also added to more actions of oppression, actually, of Gazan people that were within the West Bank borders. There were workers, Gazan workers, that were working in the West Bank that they also have been laid off.
Just to add to what Bayan said, she mentioned, and it's really important how the Palestinian Authority is seen as allowing the revenge massacre on Gaza to happen, not speaking out loud enough about it. And the pressure is building on it as well. After the blast at Al Ahli, then they declared a day of mourning while at the same time shooting live ammunition at the protesters, as Bayan said. And actually, they were pressured, the Palestinian Authority was pressured a few days ago into calling a general strike in the West Bank and Eastern Jerusalem. And yesterday, and this is something that it's an attempt to kind of to kind of ease the pressure on them, but at the same time, it is very, very obvious that the anger of Palestinian masses in the West Bank is continuing to build. And we have seen yesterday very impressive protests against the visit of Blinken as well. And definitely we're going to see more, I think, in the coming period as as the horrific situation continues to escalate.
Thanks very much for that update. I think it is extremely important and useful update into the mood and consciousness in the Occupy West Bank. And it does pose the question of what type of movement and resistance is necessary given this complete disillusionment with the Palestinian Authority and people seeing the limitations, to put it lightly. That does pose the question of, yeah, what type of resistance is necessary? I said, and the socialist struggle movement and ISA are clear that Palestinians have the right to defend themselves, arms in hand, against the military siege and occupation. But of course, we've already spoken about some of the limitations, the reactionary nature of Hamas's attacks and how counterproductive they are. So I was just wondering, Yasha, can you give us an insight into the actions, ideology, methods of this group, and what is the most effective way to resist the murderous onslaught in Gaza?
Yes. So that I will start with answering your last question and then I go to the first. Because obviously in this situation it's urgent for residents in Gaza and also in the West Bank under a military attack to organize self-defense, including through partisan warfare against the invading troops. And the most effective way to organize it is through an election of action committees that would be accountable to the communities and under the democratic control of the residents themselves as part of a strategy of building a mass struggle, which means building towards mass actions against the occupying regime, like strikes and civil disobedience. And I will not have the time to go into it, but I would emphasize that throughout the decades, the Palestinian masses have a very rich experience and traditions of mass actions and mass resistance, starting from the first Intifada and up until the recent war of May 2021. But such mass actions are in contradiction to the political program and also to the methods and strategy of Hamas and also other militias who act in a secretive way according to their own agenda without any real accountability to anyone. And we, as socialists, we oppose indiscriminate rocket fire, indiscriminate shootings and harming of civilian population, and in particularly of working and poor women and men from any national community. The thing is, what is the political effect of indiscriminate rocket fires that harm ordinary residents? Yeah, and the political effect of that is actually giving more legitimacy to the Israeli regime among its own population, and this is politically used as an excuse for the Israeli establishment to mobilize more support for even more barbaric attacks against the Palestinians under siege and occupation. And in this way, they are basically, you know, strengthening their position, while on the other hand, as I mentioned again, mass actions, also not only in theory, but what we saw in the recent decades, in recent years, did manage to, you know, have cracks within the Israeli society and to raise questions among the oppressed and the among section of the workers of why the Israeli regime continue to impose its brutal military occupation on millions of Palestinians.
I know in my discussions with friends and family who are looking on, helpless at the siege in Gaza and the slaughter, they do have questions about what type of resistance is necessary. I think some people have genuine questions about Hamas, particularly a healthy response to what they see is, correctly see is, imbalanced coverage from mainstream media, and often some of the characterizations of Hamas being peppered with, you know, racist, Islamophobic dog whistles, and they have a healthy kind of rejection to that. But I think it would be helpful to, if you could give us a real insight into the actions, ideology, the methods of Hamas, to kind of maybe take up some of these ideas and conceptions that exist in this group.
Yeah, I think this is also connected to the kind of image that Hamas as a movement tried to create itself throughout the years, and part of it was created just simply contraposing itself to the Fatah and the Palestinian Authority, that again, as was emphasized during this interview, is in acute legitimacy crisis in being seen by millions of Palestinians as basically a subcontractor of the occupation. And on the background of that, Hamas aims to pose itself as a kind of a resistance movement that is ready to challenge the Israeli regime militarily, something that is not been done, neither by the Palestinian Authority, but also not by the other regimes in the region. If you are speaking about Egypt or Jordan, that are, you know, in close ties with the Israeli regime. But I think what is more interesting to look into it is also the differences between the image that is tried to portray and the actual reality, because Hamas leadership knows that it's not capable of defeating the Israeli state military, and it's also a political force with a right-wing and pro-capitalist program and agenda that is being blurred by this image. They maybe don't have the same ideology as the regime in Iran, but would aspire to a kind of state in Palestine, which would be not fundamentally different. And in Gaza, when they have the local authorities under their control, they did implement it. Political repression and also attacks on Gazan workers and the poor, oppression of women and of LGBTQ people, and also instances of religious corruption. But by the end of the day, Hamas leaders also relied on their independence on the regimes in the region, on the imperialist powers. And for a period of years, they managed to coexist, quote unquote, with the Israeli regime and actually with the Netanyahu government through a whole range of different arrangements of how to sustain the untenable status quo of occupation in the West Bank and the siege on Gaza, while they were not the one that perpetrating that, but out of a deadlock strategy, were ready to for a large period of time to have those deals arranged until they collapse under the pressure of circumstances and also under this move of the Israeli regime towards a normalization deal in the region with Saudi that were extremely challenging for the Hamas leadership to sustain its position. And therefore, what we saw is the eruption of this war crisis, but it did not change the character and the methods and the program of Hamas, but exactly the contrary. What we saw on 7th of October on display is more of the reactionary features. And what we see now is a very acute need for an alternative to be built among the Palestinians to both the dead-end policies of the Palestinian Authority and the Fatah regime on the one hand, and the Hamas movement on the other.
Just to go back on something you said earlier about the counterproductive nature of indiscriminate rocket fire, was that it doesn't actually attempt to open up the very real cracks in Israeli society. And that does bring me to my next question, which is the fact that for a large part of this year, I think we saw those cracks in very sharp relief because there was a historic mass movement against the deeply popular Netanyahu government's attempt at a judicial coup. I want to ask, how is this government seen now in the light of the current war crisis? We've seen that there's been protest vigils of the families of hostages, even people sleeping outside the Israeli military headquarters in Tel Aviv. So, can you tell us a bit about the current mood and how this, the contradictions of that current mood, but also how they could develop further on?
So Yasha mentioned earlier cracks in the, and I think that that is important. I mean, I think that in the 10 months of the protest movement that was called the protest movement for democracy against the judicial coup of the Netanyahu and far-right government, the developed an anger, really like a deep anger towards the settler religious and far right among significant layers of Israeli society. And we've seen that anger being expressed also in feminist sentiments, in LGBTQ sentiment, pro-LGBTQ sentiments. We've seen a deep distrust and, as I said, anger towards this government develop. And all of that hasn't disappeared during this war crisis. I don't want to make it sound, I mean, everything that I'm going to talk about, I mean, there is reactionary, all very nationalistic mood within the Jewish Israeli society, which was fueled, as we spoke before, it was fueled by the reactionary nature of the Hamas attacks. But that reactionary mood in Israeli society, the support for the war in Gaza is very high. But at the same time, Yasha was speaking about cracks, and it is very clear that an eruption of anti-government protests, not anti-war, anti-government protests, is a matter of time. It was exposed very early on during this war crisis with unprecedented low levels of support towards the government, Netanyahu. This is something that is unprecedented usually in previous bouts of bloodshed and war. It was at first a lot of support, and as it continues, and as the war continued, the support would go down. By the way, in the 2006 war against waged against Lebanon, it actually reached single digits of support for the prime minister towards the end. But now we're already seeing really very low levels of support. And we've seen it not only in polls, but also the ministers of the government, they can't go anywhere. We've seen them being kicked out of hospitals, screamed at. People are yelling at them. They're not saying, you let Hamas do this to us or something like that. They're saying, you are to blame. You are at fault for this. Now, as I said before, it cannot be conflated with opposition to the war. And the sentiment of replacing Netanyahu and the far right with establishment figures who wouldn't say stuff like nuking Gaza, who in the eyes of like more mainstream layers could manage this better, is a prominent mood. But we do see that at the same time, the far populist and religious right wing is continuing to promote their ultra-nationalistic and fanatic agenda, the ethnic cleansing that we mentioned and is actually not supported. It's one of the contradictions. It's actually something that even mainstream layers are opposing that. We also see that in the criticism of transferring money. The government is transferring money to the settlement at the expense of working families within the 1948 territories. We also see sexist rhetoric. For example, blaming a rabbi, blaming the victims of the Nova Party massacre for dressing in an immodest way. That was the reason why they were murdered. And also the political and nationalistic witch hunt, which actually forces certain elements of the democratic protests, which and now they're forced to face the questions of what kind of democracy, to who, and to what extent. And actually, all of the elements that I mentioned force Israelis who would prefer to focus on their grief and anger to confront the ideas and ask themselves questions. And the questions, is this the way to continue living here? And what is the ruling class offering? Now, at the moment, those who ask the questions are really maybe in a small minority even, but it is very clear that there is potential for class struggle and radicalization to develop within the Israeli working class as well. And I think that especially around the issue of the hostages held in Gaza, the development of dissent against the government, because the government has no interest in a ceasefire or any type of deal, because it would undermine what they want to achieve, and it would stop their momentum in continuing the bombings and atrocities. While not all the government members say out loud that they don't want to bring the hostages back, some actually have said that. And the families of those people that were kidnapped will not accept this. And 2 days ago, we actually saw a mass protest demanding the release of the hostages when it's illegal to be gathering more than 50 people. And very interestingly, this was not a left-wing protest, but very interesting, there is a split developing within the families that are fighting against the government around this issue, where some of the families are calling for all, because there are more than 10,000 Palestinian political prisoners. More than 150 of them are children, actually, and minors. And some of the families are demanding all for all. But others are saying stuff like no ceasefire until the hostages are returned. So we see that the political divide is also in this issue becoming very clear, and it will probably develop more into serious arguments within Israeli society. And that is important because it helps expose the government and their agenda, I think.
Yeah, as for now, like more 42,000 unemployed people are in Israel. Like were added since the war, and like about 26,000 also were put on unpaid leave, also because of the inflation that reached a new record, I think. Since like 20 years ago. Actually, this is added like to the economic crisis that have been like in Israel's before actually the war. Also, we should mention that people are estimating that the cost of the war may reach like about $52 billion when it will end. This is like a really big number that instead of investing it in rehabilitation, in health system, in welfare, in houses destructed, in many many crises that were like have been really developed actually before the war, the Israeli regime is preferring to invest it on more wars that will really not reach to anything but a more bloodshed.
So both speakers there just gave an insight into some of the contradictions, some of the crises, social, political and economic, that are opening up within Israeli society. We heard earlier about developing protest movements in the region and also demonstrations in the occupied West Bank. We also heard about some of the very rich traditions of resistance within the Palestinian struggle, drawing lessons from the First Intifada, ones I think that need to be relearned to build the necessary movement and program required for today. So with that in mind, I want to go to Yasha and ask, what are socialist struggle movement calling for at this point in time?
Yeah, so we start with a series of immediate demands. Yeah, for a ceasefire, for the stoppage of the bloody war and massacre in Gaza, to stop the bombing, to halt the ground invasion. But of course, these immediate demands are also interlinked with the need for a fast and comprehensive prisoners and hostages deal, and also for the end of the siege and blockade of Gaza and the end of the collective punishment of its population. And we connect that for our call for the solidarity with all the victims of this war and our opposition to state terrorism, but also to harming of civilians and against indiscriminate shootings of bullets and rockets and terrorism in general. And for these demands to become achievable, you need obviously to build a force behind them. And we call for demonstration, protest and strikes, such as the dignity strike of May 2021 on both sides of the green line here, as part of a mass struggle which will be democratically organized through elected action committees that will also take care of the much needed self-defense in this situation against the prosecution and against the state forces and the far right, and in parallel of that, of this much needed struggle for national and social liberation of the Palestinians, on the other side of the national divide is the need to rebuild a cross-national community mass movement against Netanyahu's government that should include also protest and strike actions, but also refusal of soldiers to participate in this horrific offensive on Gaza as part of a struggle for democracy, equality, for the well-being and security of every person. And of course, this can be achieved only in a framework of going forward for an independent, democratic, socialist Palestinian state with equal rights and part of a struggle for democracy and socialist change in Israel and in the region that will guarantee an equal rights for all nations and minorities. And to realize that, there should be also be a solution to the refugees question through agreement that would include recognition of the historical injustice and the right of those who wish to return while guaranteeing a life of welfare and equality for all residents. I think this cannot be guaranteed without addressing the root of this crisis, which is the extreme barbaric national oppression of millions of Palestinians, but also the crisis-ridden capitalist system in the region and globally, and the role that is played by global and regional imperialist powers. And therefore, we are emphasizing that in the face of the horrors of this bloody crisis, what is much needed is a struggle of working and poor people around the globe, around an agenda of a socialist change. And this is also what is being put forward by the ISA in different countries. As the only real way out.
Thanks for that, Yasha. I think many of our speakers will have participated in some of the protest movements that we've discussed, have been developing and will continue to develop around the world. Obviously, this horrific situation has sparked great outrage amongst workers, youth, and the oppressed internationally. So what can our listeners around the world do right now and going forward?
Yeah, so I think the starting point would be the fact that there would be already hundreds of thousands, in fact millions, around the globe that took to the streets. And in many countries, in the face of state repression, this is true even for the so-called capitalist advanced countries in the West, whether it's in France, in Germany, and also to a certain extent in the US. And I think that as the war escalates, it's time to escalate actions. It's time to move forward from rallies and marches to mass actions of civil disobedience that should be including shutdowns of roads, should be including of mass protests in front of embassies of the Israeli state, in front of ministries of governments that are backing up this brutal war, with a call for an immediate ceasefire and immediate stoppage of all bombardments. Another thing that we saw just in the recent days is quite an inspiring example that was set by the Transport Workers Union in Belgium, that called upon its members to refuse to handle military equipment that are being sent from the airports in Belgium to the Israeli army. They literally decided that they will not handle bombs, which shows a very direct way in which we can, as workers, take part of that. And there would be more trade union and labor associations around the globe that are already discussing to halt any loading and offloading of Israeli goods as long as a ceasefire is not declared and as long as this brutal war continues. And this is definitely an action that we should call for, assist through, and build. This is just only part of the things that can, you know, help to mount up the pressure that has been already building up globally, and from there to move on forward with the demands for a complete end of the occupation, of the siege, of all of the policies of oppression of the Palestinians, and for a much needed root solution for a socialist change in the region, but also on a global scale.
Thank you, Yasha, and of course thank you to Val and Bian for what's been, I imagine, a very challenging episode for our speakers and for many of our listeners, but one that's been enormously clarifying in helping us understand the roots and causes of this current conflict, this war crisis, of this brutal siege and slaughter in Gaza, how it fits in to a new era of global capitalist crisis characterized by inter-imperialist tensions and rivalries. But also our speakers have gone in to what type of movement, what type of struggle, what type of organizations and political program will ultimately be necessary to bring the bloodshed to an end. Of course, that's an anti-capitalist, that's a socialist struggle that they've outlined today. It's going to be an international one. It already is, and it's one in which international socialist alternative have been involved in every corner of the globe and will continue to play a role as these develop over the next period. I want to finish by making a very important appeal, a financial appeal that has been launched by International Socialist Alternative, and that's to support the work of socialist struggle movement. All donations will directly help to build a strong movement of working class and oppressed people against the far-right Netanyahu regime, to promote mobilisation and organisation of demonstrations and marches among both national communities. And we want to build a movement to stop the carnage and slaughter in Gaza, to end the siege, occupation and oppression of Palestinian people, for that to be connected to a broader struggle against capitalism and imperialism in the region and of course globally. If you go on to internationalsocialist.net, you'll see our financial appeal. You'll see a number of ways in which you can donate. And of course, any donation, big or small, is enormously welcome and important to fund this absolutely crucial work. We'll end there. And again, I'd like to thank our speakers and our listeners. We'll hopefully be back very soon with an update and analysis in these fast developing events. Solidarity.
This is World to Win, with speakers from across the globe, bringing you the latest news and analysis on the fast-moving global events from a socialist perspective. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram, because there's a lot to do, and we have a world to win.
When they fight!
We win!
When they fight!
We win!
When they fight!
We win!
Solidarity!